Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. Imagine you had experienced life as humans have lived during most of the 150,000 years since we evolved in Africa. Our guest, Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, need not imagine it, she did. While millions know her as the author of The Hidden Life of Dogs and Tribe of Tiger, did you know that Ms. Thomas and her family were the first outsiders to live among the Bushmen in the Kalahari Desert in the 1950s? They still lived in what Ms. Thomas calls the Old Way. In her extraordinary book, she's named The Old Way, A Story of the First People. Ms. Thomas revisits the Bushmen culture and lifestyle, the story she says she's tapped into in everything she's ever written. With 10,000 years of agriculture blinding us to our profound connections with the rest of nature, what's the surprising key Ms. Thomas chose to unlock the mysteries of humanity's deep past?
I wrote a book about dogs, The Hidden Life of Dogs, and a book about cats, Tribe of Tiger. And I did that because these are non-human things that are very observable for us and very accessible for us. So anybody can look at their own dog, and if they know what to look for, they can see, they see all kinds of things that are going on out in the woods, and it's a connection. And anything not to be just human, and things that humans have invented and things that humans diddle with, and just something to connect to the natural world. So that's why I did that. And those books, they have in them stuff that I learned in the Kalahari. Not necessarily happy stuff, but stuff nevertheless.
Elizabeth Marshall Thomas's book, The Old Way, is her definitive exploration of humanity's deep past. In it, she combines her own and her family's experiences with the Bushmen in the 1950s with her 50 subsequent years of writing and study. Ms. Thomas is widely known for her nonfiction books, The Harmless People and Warrior Herdsman. I first discovered Ms. Thomas through her remarkable novels, Reindeer Moon and The Animal Family, a combination of storytelling prowess and vivid observation. Bill Russell and I share Liz Thomas's hunger to know how deeply we all are part of the natural world. When she welcomed us for several days of recording in her home in Peterborough, New Hampshire, we were keenly aware of the privilege we had. We were going exploring with the last outsider alive who'd had pristine access to the old way. Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, I have been blessed with lots of different traditions, thinking about the three ways to do that and the two ways to do something else and the eight-way path and the 12. It seems to me that one could arguably say, know thyself, and everything can flow from that. I had the sense, as I relished in the old way, that you were giving me an opportunity that was available in no other way to know myself. As you wrote this, as you experienced it, as you looked back over 50 years later at the experience itself of living with the first people in the old way, that there was a chance for you to know thyself both individually and as a species. Now, am I being my usual fanciful self here?
I did feel it was, to me, ever since I was there, I saw everything through the lens of that experience, through the lens of the Kalahari. And I think it helped me see what of myself was human and what was a sort of add-on, and I, in other people too, for that matter. And it was a very valuable experience.
I am, as you know, so smitten with knowing someone. Being one removed even is just this immense opportunity to think about the human animal in ways that are just extraordinary. You can't do that anymore, can you?
There are people in present-day Namibia, who may still remember the how to live in that way, but not very many. They would be people somewhat younger than myself, but, I mean, the people who are my age would remember. And people much somewhat younger than that, it was pretty well coming to an end by then, so there will most people now are younger and would not remember. So I'm one of the very few people alive in the world who saw the old way. I mean,
but you more than saw it, you lived in it. You experienced it. Your mother and father stayed for years.
Mm-hmm, yes, they did.
This wasn't an ecotourism experience.
No. We lived there. But also tried to understand the life and tried to and participate as much as was within our power. And it was something to know. What worries me is that, I mean, who am I? Some woman up in New Hampshire knows it. Well, that's nothing. It's gone. I mean, and knowing it is gone and going. And so...
And once it's gone, it's gone.
Once it's gone, it's gone.
Yeah. You have a wonderful metaphor. I think you credit Richard Dawkins for it. And it seems germane to this of the 180,000 years of individuals holding hands.
Not just individuals. Yes.
Women actually holding hands going all the way back, and that's the continuity. And you were in that continuity. You're one of the last handholders.
One of the last handholders, yes, that's true. Dawkins, and it's, you imagine yourself standing by your mother holding her hand, and she's holding her mother's hand. And you go back hundreds of miles, thousands of years, millions of years. And it's a chimpanzee whose hand you're holding.
Or a blue-green algae.
Or, indeed.
Beyond the chimp, yeah.
But then you have problems with the hands. That was a late addition.
That's right. That's right.
You can agglomerate, maybe. We have the distinct honor and pleasure to be in Peterborough, New Hampshire, with the inestimably wonderful Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, who we are pleased to call friend, pleased to call Liz, and pleased to invite you back when we continue the conversation. Elizabeth Marshall Thomas has welcomed us into her home and welcomed all of us into the life that is the human experience that you have called so elegantly the old way. Has that image, that way of framing it, always been with you? Have you always thought of it as the old way?
For a long time. For a long time, yes. Yes. And once everything in the natural world lives by what I would call the old way, and indeed it is the old way. It's as old as life on earth, and with various changes, and people alone and domestic animals today live not in the old way, but we see ourselves as the, in our civilization or whatever, as the natural thing, and everything else is dispensable, which of course anybody listening to this program probably realizes is far from true. But when it was helpful to me to see people living in with what I also call the old rules, which is that what is determining your what you do, it's weather, it's rainfall, wildfires, that kind of thing, and sort of natural events. And you must adjust to this. You don't have control over it. You don't think of controlling it. The people did not think of controlling the weather or anything like that. They it was interesting because they're far from it. I mean, we assume that the rain dance means to bring rain. No, the rain dance that people did was to use the power of the rain for their own benefit and to partake of the power of the natural world, which I think is a very different way of looking at things than how we look at things.
Well, you use the word control, the illusion that we have that somehow mm-hmm. we are in control. Maybe the silliest thing we ever invented. Is that a tool?
It may be. I think it started with agriculture. I mean, we did gain some... Well, when you want to have agriculture, you must then exert some control as much as you can over what is going on in your world of planting, world of animals. You can't let predators take your livestock. You have to water your plants if... Presumably, or at least you have to cultivate them, and that's that, then I think that gave us an illusion of being in control, and also the high desirability of being able to control the natural world. And I think that, but the Bushmen didn't have that at all. That just wasn't, it wasn't part of their picture. And theirs was in reality a much more appropriate way to look at the world than we look at it. But we're kind of out of luck because it's so ingrained in our culture. There is no way that our culture is ever going to move away from what we've got. I don't see from what we've got. And I do think that, we're going to have to try to, we're going to have to use control in order not to keep on putting up greenhouse gases. We're going to have to try to control. So the control is built in there, but it was interesting that to live at a time when it wasn't. Oh, to live in a situation when it wasn't, with people for whom it wasn't.
We're talking more about the environment, more about ecologies now. A friend of ours in Montana introduced, it was the first time I'd heard somebody include, as a matter of policy, humans as part of the environment. That the ecology is all of us, that it's not something out there. It's not, you know, I think we tend to think of it that nature is separate from us.
Yes.
And that we're not part of nature.
That's
and
right.
That the environment, we're not part of the environment and we're not part of the ecology.
That's right.
And one of the things I found just eye-opening, riveting, revealing about your recounting of how these people lived is they were clearly, manifestly built into the environment. They were part of the ecology. The environment attended to them in a variety of different ways, and they were very attentive to their environment. It's a wonderful story.
Thanks. I'm glad you thought so. But yeah, I mean, we evolved there, and we are part of the lions evolved also as a savanna, African savanna animal. We did too. And I think after the rainforests got thinned out and then diminished, and we just kept some of our rainforest ways. I mean, you don't change things unless you have to. If something is working for you, you keep doing it. And this is part of the old way. This was true of other creatures too. Lots of animals have culture. They have cultural differences in different populations. But and so, of course we did too. Now I can't remember what I was going to say.
Well,
nuts.
We'll find our way back to that.
Okay.
I was particularly interested that for all that we say there was not a sense of control, it was the arrogant sense of control that was missing. It wasn't that there were no controls. Any natural system has all kinds of controls. Mm-hmm. The weather itself is a control. And it's not as if these people were anarchists. These people had very clear social boundaries.
What I meant was that they did not try to control the environment as one does when one is an agriculturist. They controlled themselves. Very,
what a concept.
Very clearly, and they did not consider controlling anything else. The only way you can do it is without heavy machinery, is with magic, and they simply didn't bother. I mean, they didn't have magic to do this and magic to do that. They had a little, but the deer don't have magic to make things happen. The lions don't have magic to make things happen. Why would we? We didn't. People assume that because they are hunter-gatherers, or they were hunter-gatherers, that they had lots of superstitions and lots of magic beliefs to explain things. They didn't. None at all.
I think one of the things that was, there's so many things that stood out as I read The Old Way. One of the many images was, no, you don't need to think about gods. Yeah, it's going to rain. It's not going to rain. There are big forces. Why would you name it? You know, it just is.
Right, exactly. That's right. It just is.
That's right. It didn't feel as if, in some ways, it was just so kind of obvious.
Then
for the next, how many, 10 or 20,000 years, we put layers and layers and layers to make it more and more complex.
There's a tendency to think of these people as primitive.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, and I'm sure that's
something. And you disabused me of that.
Something you've been dealing with ever since. But the natural assumption is the old way is a primitive way.
And this is an improvement now.
And that what we do now is much more modern and progressive and smarter and all the things that lend to our... it boosts our egos.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I, as much as anything, the tangible participation in the world around them in a very realistic fashion, not denying things mm-hmm. that were real, not trying to fabricate things, mm-hmm. not trying to influence influence things that they couldn't influence, to me was, it not only was it not primitive, given where we are today, it looked extraordinarily forward-looking.
And sophisticated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, it's almost as if, and I don't think this is your intention, but it's almost as if we took a serious wrong turn in a lot of ways, and I don't mean to overstate that, but that agriculture, we paid a price for the agriculture, for the illusion of power, and for the gods that came with that.
Because mm-hmm. yes.
Mostly our gods are agricultural gods.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
But
agricultural sky gods. Yes.
Well, sky and fertility and all the things that go with it. But the disabusing us of our sense of these people as primitive, to me, was a remarkable insight.
Primitive in an insulting sense.
Oh, sure.
I think to this day, people like that are thought of as primitive in an insulting sense. And I mean, someone wrote a review of this very book and said in it, he said that I should make a great effort to assure the reader that these people are human, something like that. It didn't occur to me that my readers aren't going to think they're not, so I didn't need to. But it's this weird idea that. However, there it is, and it's because we so value our automobiles and all that we've got that we think that this is, and it's easier to live as we live, and you live longer probably. I think our infant mortality in America is pretty high, I think, but in more civilized countries, it is less. And I don't know, the Bushmen didn't have very high infant mortality; they had a low birth weight, which is better, beats
much
infant
better
mortality.
I think we could all agree that that's
a
better way.
Low
birth rate, yeah.
When I first heard you say that, I thought you said low birth weight, but they had healthy babies.
Oh, they had very healthy babies, yes, absolutely.
And if you have this really touching chapter where people just didn't want to talk about it, but if they couldn't sustain the whole group by virtue of having a baby that was out of the cycle, that baby just didn't come into the world.
If you couldn't, people could nurse, a woman could nurse one baby. In this country, there are people who nurse twins and so forth, but they don't have to. And nobody's going to die if it doesn't work out. But if with the Bushmen, you could, and they themselves had very low-fat diet and lots of exercise, so they spent lots of calories getting the calories that they were able to eat. And there were no fat people. There were no people. Everybody was thin.
Which is a good thing.
Which is a good thing. It was a very good thing. But the babies, and you could nurse one baby. If you couldn't, if you had another baby before that, the first baby was self-sufficient, you would undernourish. If you were trying to nurse it, you would malnourish two kids, and you could lose both of them. So people didn't. I mean, but there was infanticide, but it was extremely rare.
Yeah.
And they didn't need to, because lactation means you don't, if you have a very lean body and low weight and low fat, you don't menstruate as quickly as mm-hmm. you do otherwise, mm-hmm. as early in life. Mm-hmm. So people were much older than we are. We're very young for menstruating.
Time and time again, I found remarkable the changes over a relatively short period of time. If you think about geological time, if you simply think about evolutionary time, what our modern stuff has done has made some pretty dramatic changes. I mean, suddenly we are awash in estrogens, and you've got all sorts of implications for boys and girls and gender stuff and sperm count and what do you do when the girls are menstruating younger and younger and younger and younger and the society keeps pushing out the age of majority, so we infantilize longer and longer and longer. Well, some of the current genuinely intractable, it seems, social things seem to be a result of what we've done to ourselves, because you don't find it, these things in the old way.
I think so too. I think a lot of that is what we've done to ourselves. Yes, yes. Well, we have no way of knowing. How could we know? We do the best we can. We do what we think is right. We do what we feel is most helpful. If we're misled, well, it's kind of an unfortunate.
Oh, well, as Elizabeth Marshall Thomas said, oh, well.
I was reading along, you know, just sort of settled into the rhythm of it and, you know, turning pages and reading and trying to absorb it. And I came across, I mean, in this context that they... I think young women now are having their first periods at as young as 8, 9, and 10.
I've heard that, too.
And there was this number that was 20, plus or minus. Mm-hmm. And I read, you know, I was reading along and saying, wait a minute. That's a full decade.
That changes
difference.
Everything.
And it really, from a social and a cultural standpoint, that to me was just a striking condition. And very surprising. I simply would never have guessed. I would have assumed that the people marry young. Yeah. So I assumed they were having children young. Yeah. It's just not the case.
We have many surprises for you, as Elizabeth Marshall Thomas has surprises for us in The Old Way and in everything she's ever written. Be with us when we return in just a moment. We're back. I'm Paula Gordon, Bill Russell, Liz Thomas, Elizabeth Marshall Thomas. The Marshall part is always there for me. It is a Liz Thomas, but the Elizabeth Marshall Thomas. Your parents, do the short course on how in the world a 19-year-old Liz and her brother John at 18, how you end up in the Kalahari, for goodness sake, when you're full-blooded American kids?
Well, my dad was a civil engineer and also started a business, but he retired at about that time. And he
Which
wanted
would be 19... Would,
and he, I think it was about 1950 that he retired. And he wanted to do something with his family. And he was the kind of person that, had he lived at another time, would have not wanted to see the smoke of his neighbor's chimney. He liked to be where people were, you know.
And needed some distance.
He needed some distance, and he loved the out of doors. Mm-hmm. He was very much a naturalist. It isn't that he knew so much about. I mean, he knew what kind of tree it was you were looking at, but he wasn't one of these real naturalists. But he just loved I think he got it from hunting. When he was younger, he had friends in the Mi'kmaq Nation who he hunted with. I think he went hunting. He never said he hunted, but he knew how to talk about moose in Mi'kmaq. And he was a dead shot.
Sign.
He was a dead shot. My Lord, he could take a rifle and see something in the distance, bang, and the thing would fall over. We'd go get the meat. And I took that for granted. But as I look back, with a little bit more sophistication, I know he did some hunting, but he never talked about it. My mother was an animal lover and protected all animals and would not have liked to think of him hunting. And he certainly didn't hunt after we were born. But he could.
Yeah, well, and that ended up being
and
quite
it did.
Important.
It was important, yeah.
When
I mean, it was. You'll never starve if you're with him, and yeah. No.
So you're in the 50s, and he retires.
He retires, and so he wanted to do this. He looked on a map. He wanted to go where there was. He wanted to go where there was nothing on the map. And back then, there were unexplored parts of, quote, unexplored parts of the world. I mean, the Bushmen had been there for...
They've been exploring it for a while.
Maybe 5 million to 35,000, somewhere in there. I mean, you know, a while.
Yes.
They knew it, but for non-Bushmen, it was unexplored. Unexplored by non-Bushmen. I think this is even true of Bantu people. They weren't in there, and they don't seem to be... I mean, there's a little disagreement in the anthropological world about whether there were Bantu people. It's that's kind of a long story and no point in getting into it, but it there was no evidence that there ever had been, and
it was just a big part of the map.
It was 120,000 square miles, I would say, a huge area, and the old sites, the dwelling sites where people lived when we met them, went back long for. Really long. Some archaeological work was done there, and they went back 30,000 years, perhaps more. The one that I know about didn't get to the bottom. They discontinued it.
So if you hadn't gone to the Kalahari, what were the kinds of other places that your dad looked at?
Well, he was looking at Tasmania also. This inner Tasmania was also blank on the map, but we just. My brother kind of like read a book about Africa and liked Africa, and we kind of thought, my dad, I guess, thought to go there. So we did. And he organized an expedition, and we went, and we spent a long time trying to find people because there's not much water. The water is in small water holes, little places where a spring comes out of the rocks, usually at the edges of seasonal lakes, which during the rainy season have soaked it up, and the rocks have caught it. So if there's a pool there, and some of them were permanent and some of them weren't, but there were very few, and people would have to be associated with them in the dry season. In the rainy season, they could be anywhere, but nobody knew where these were. They were. Vague ideas about where some of them were.
So you didn't just go check into a motel?
No.
call up Bob's Guide Service. Well, you say nobody knew. The Bushmen, of course, did know.
Oh yeah, they knew everyone. I mean, there were no maps. So none of us. When I say nobody, right. It meant nobody on our side of things really knew where they were or had any idea.
So how many are we talking about when you say the Bushmen? Are there? Is this big numbers? Are we talking about millions of people in this unmapped by Europeans? How's that?
I was once told. I mean, somebody once came up with a figure of roughly. Nobody knew how many people there were, and to this day, I don't think anybody really knows how many people there were. I would say. I mean, I think somebody suggested 20,000, and that does not seem out of reason to me. The population density was calculated at one person for 9 square miles or one person for 10 square miles.
And these are the first people.
These would be
speaking?
First only Bushmen, first people. Yeah.
And there are all sorts of subtleties that go around that people can explore reading The Old Way themselves if they want to know the particulars. But it's important to say not only did you not know what was there, you didn't know who was there or how find them.
That's
and
right.
This is big country.
And it's big country.
And it's not particularly welcoming to someone who's not native to that country. It looked pretty... I walked into the Harvard Peabody Museum with you once and saw this image, and you said, that's what it looked like. Oh, my goodness!
Yes, very dry. Well, it wasn't a desert with just sand. It had its own ecosystem, its own kinds of plants, and plenty of them. I mean, a very varied, but it was a dry ecosystem. And most of the year, and it expected to be. I mean, so it was doing well the way it was. Even the animals, even the birds and birds, even all the vertebrates, there were even amphibians. But they would, I mean, to show the length of time, they would sleep through the dry part and then come out when it rained. Start being active when it rained, and then they go back to sleep for a long, long time. And so it was really, but go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I was telling a friend that we were going to be talking about lots of things, including the stories you tell in The Old Way, and that I thought he would find it riveting. And he said, oh, you mean there's something to be learned in it? I said, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And part of it is your elegant first couple of chapters in setting the predicates for what kind of animal we are. To me, perhaps the great liberation in my life is to be, I mean, truly, the great liberation is to be able to think in Darwinian terms about the human animal. Isn't that an awesome gift to be given? And then to have lived it and walked it and talked it, and your mother recording it and your brother filming it and you writing about it over the course of 50 years. Isn't that just astonishing?
Yes. It is to me, and it was a great piece of luck that we, it was huge good fortune that we were able to do that and also to be there when there was no trace. Later anthropologists came and they worked in areas where there were dogs and cattle and so forth. There were plenty of bushmen, but anthropologists don't know. They know so little about the natural world, and it doesn't occur to them that if there are dogs, this may be having an effect on the other animals, which in turn will be having an effect on the people and the kind of luck they find when they go hunting, that sort of thing. If they have cattle, that will affect the natural world. It will affect the lions, and it could, and it did. But without any of that, we were able to see an ecosystem in which there were no domestic animals, no domestic plants, just our people, human beings, as part of it. And this is with no introduction of anything later, no agriculture, no pastoralism, no nothing. And that's what I think was so valuable and why we were so lucky.
There's a Spartanness to this space. Mm-hmm. In a lush environment, you have, there's more latitude for living. In this kind of environment, everybody in it, and I'm thinking from this evolutionary standpoint, the margins are so thin that if you're not very, very well adapted to that particular, mm-hmm. not only the immediate environment, but the cycle of the environment, water and not water, the niches are very clear, it would seem, and the adaptations are in some ways, from our standpoint, as compared to a lush environment, are it would seem very clear that you have to have this kind of, you have to be able to deal with the absence of water.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Let Liz think about that for just a moment. We'll go away and come right back so I don't have to interrupt you as you begin to respond to this line of inquiry. We're with Elizabeth Marshall Thomas. We are pleased to be in Peterborough, New Hampshire, being here. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon. You be with us when we return in a moment. Elizabeth Marshall Thomas has welcomed us into her home here in Peterborough, New Hampshire. I'm Paula Gordon. Bill Russell, you were talking about these niches and the clarity of living with or without water.
It really is a question. It seems from the outside, we particularly in modern developed world, we got a lot of latitude. We can go find water lots of different places. We can find food lots of different places, and the broader ecology, those things we haven't wiped out. There's latitude in this really constrained environment. It would seem that the ecology, that there would be a crispness to it that would not be the case. That you literally had to adapt or die. And that those adaptations had occurred over millennia, and maybe millions of years. So I would think just being able to see that and see humans in that kind of precision, and for them to survive, they had to have adapted, which made them very integral to the natural system, didn't it?
They were one of the fauna of the African savanna, and an important one. They were not the top predators. The lions had that honor. I think there were wild dogs were much more. Wild dogs are another top predator. Wild dogs nail just about everything they go after. They have a huge success rate, which people did not. People had a good success rate. I'm going to take that back. I think wild dogs ate. I read Richard Estes, who's a marvelous field biologist. He wrote that. Wild dogs had breakfast, dinner, and lunch on an almost daily basis. And people, it would take, and this was in Serengeti, but people would take, but wild dogs are very successful. So even there were two predators that were better off than us. But
so humans didn't get breakfast, lunch, and dinner?
No. People for the hunting part, they only part of their food came from hunting as opposed to wild dogs. But it could take days and days to successfully complete a hunt. And it would take several days or a long time perhaps to find something to shoot, put a poison arrow in it, then you have to follow it for days until the poison does its work and the animal is too sick to go on. The people themselves said lions were better hunters than they were, which I thought was, I mean, forthright people. Gosh,
hats off to the adapted,
and hats off to the people for not putting themselves first.
What a concept! One of the many, many things as I read my way through, and again thinking about these niches, talk about who gets the sunlight and who gets the coolness. Talk about who gets to pick who's going to go to the waterhole in the day and who's going to go at night. I love this.
Well, with lions are water dependent. They have to drink water. People have to drink water every day. Lions have to. All the predators have to. But the antelope did not. They were water independent. They can go for a season, days or a season. They do it by raising their inner temperature, raising their body temperature. And if ours went up to that extent, we'd die. But they do fine. They stay in the shade, and they graze at night or browse at night. And there's a little bit of moisture in the dew, so they get a little bit from that. But also they spend their energy at night and stand in the shade in the daytime. Okay. They're a different story, a whole different story from those who need to drink water. Okay, there's only a few water holes, so there isn't one for the lions and one for the people. There's one for everybody. And the people and the lions divided the time so that the people used it by day, and the whole area, the whole territory, not only just drinking from the water hole, but doing their hunting. The lions hunted at night. The people hunted in the daytime. Their paths just about never crossed unless the people never went to take a visit and look at the lions. Now and then the lions would come and take a look and visit the people to see what was going on, and you'd see these big eyes and three or four pairs of big green eyes, and you know the lions. The lions are back, and the bushmen, you know, what do they want, and why are they doing this? But the bushmen always successfully... they talk to them in strong tones, but not rude tones. I mean, the tone was just firm and strong and respectful. And we spoke respectfully to the lions, and the lions would sort of stand around and maybe grumble a little bit, but then they just go.
So who got the day and who got the night and how?
The lions got the night and the people got the day. The only times, as I was saying, when they came together would be if the lions wanted to and came to the bushmen.
I have always assumed, I just want to finish this, I've always assumed, well, of course the day is all you want. I mean, of course you want to be... Mm. Well, let's see. If you're on the savanna and it's really hot,
yes,
which is the better time to have?
Oh, yes, that issue. Night is absolutely the preferred time. Some birds, and not all, and a few mammals, including people, are diurnal. Everything else is nocturnal. The night is vastly preferable.
So we get
second best.
That's humbling. Mm-hmm.
That's because somebody else is top of the food chain.
That's right. Somebody else was top of the food chain. That's right.
The cultural relationship, and I use culture with respect to both populations, the relationship between humans and lions, as you recount it, is a remarkable story. The adaptations, and those adaptations juxtaposed or contraposed to how it was in other areas and how it became.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very much so.
To me, it's just a fascinating story.
Very much so. The people and the lions had a very strong, essentially unviolated hands-off policy. There are instances of lions attacking people in that area, but the ones that people have brought to my attention to refute my presentation are after 1980, and that by that time it was too late. I mean, but then there were cattle, there was stuff, there was...
And the deal was off?
The deal was off by then. The
Between the lions and the humans.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It was a whole different story. But there was no reason not to have a truce. It was better for everybody to have a different time of day, different... They hunted the same animals. They drank from the same water. They lived very much the same. A pride of lions weighed about the same as a group of bushmen.
A pride of people.
A pride of people, yeah. And if you weighed them all up and put them on a big celestial balance beam, they would be about the same.
Huh.
So it took about the same amount of meat to feed one or the other. So they all went after big animals. They would take the little ones, but their quarry was the big ones. They also, let's see, what else? Cooperated with childcare, had groups of, they were related, people were often, the lions, I don't know the composition of every lion pride, and so who knows, are there those in there who are friends? Well, male lions have friends, but not necessarily littermates, but I don't know about the females. But
are both of them hierarchical?
Essentially there was a relationship, a kinship was involved in the groups. This is true of lions, and it's true of people. They cooperate in childcare, both of them.
There's a tendency, I'm listening to you talking about lions, and I'm listening to you, and I'm thinking, well, she's going to say that all lions do this, and all lion, all antelopes do this, but what appears to be the case is each pride has, there is individuality. There are individuals within the group, just as there are with the bushmen. And then the tendency is to say, all bushmen are the same.
Yeah, that's right.
If I'm an anthropologist, I go down. You've seen one, you've seen them all.
You would refute that, wouldn't you?
I think there's cultural variety, there is individual variety, of course, and other creatures have that too, just as, not necessarily in the same ways we do, but they have it, and I think that's something people should take into account when they're thinking about other kinds of creatures. But to go back to the lions and the people, it worked out best when they did their hunting at different times of day and so forth and so on.
And this had evolved over eons.
I don't know when it. I mean, I. It was. Why didn't the lions hunt the people? I don't know. I don't even have a good idea. I mean, the people could decimate the lions if they wanted to with poison arrows, but the lions could decimate the people much faster. And a lion wounded with a poison arrow isn't going to die for several days.
So can kill a lot of people
in that
in the
time,
meantime.
He can do quite a number on on the people. There's no place to go. You can't go up a tree. I mean, the trees aren't big enough. And the lions can, if it's big enough for a person to climb, I mean, there are some trees that a person could climb and be safe from a lion, but they're not everywhere. And you have to be near one if the, it just isn't, the idea of making war on lions just is a very impractical one. And the people had spears that were short. I don't think I have one. Those are Dadaw spears from the Maasai-like people. They hunted lions.
But they were also...
They were pastoralists. But the Bushmen's equipment was hunting equipment, not in battle equipment, and they didn't. The idea of spearing a lion would be extremely risky. They just didn't, and there's no point in taking great risks if your group depends on you, and if they depend on your food getting ability, and then you are all torn up. They have to take care of you. It just doesn't work that way.
Well, this is, again, is one of the lessons. We tend to think in black and white terms.
Mm-hmm.
Either we're good friends, we can make pets out of the lions.
That's right.
Or they're our terminal enemies.
That's right.
And this is life at the margin.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, a small error can have big consequences. Mm-hmm, and the lions, you know, probably as well as humans understand that, you know,
whether it's
rationalized, put in the linguistic terms, written up in the lion anthropologist notes or whatever. But that, and there's a piece of this that it seems to be germane, and that's the oblique. The rather than confronting one another or running from one another, there's a tendency to shear off one direction or the other, which seems to me to be almost metaphorical for that relationship. It was not black and white. They would encounter one another and then move off at an angle.
Move off at an angle, yes.
In both cases.
In both cases.
The subtlety of which we are speaking is explored by Elizabeth Marshall Thomas in The Old Way, as she did talking about the lions in Tribe of Tiger, as many have come to know her in The Hidden Life of Dogs. Those who have read your novels, you have given us many opportunities to learn more about who and what we are, and we'll give each other that opportunity when we return in a moment. This is the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge, of whom there is no better exemplar than Elizabeth Marshall Thomas. Bill Russell and I are pleased to be with you here in Peterborough, New Hampshire.
We tend to think of leading edges as being solely forward-looking, and it's part of what makes this, you know, Paula says leading edge. She says that about historians sometimes, and people say, nah, they're not leading edge, they're backward-looking. We're talking about people here who anatomically or culturally are very similar to people who lived 100,000 years ago.
And also 50,000
years
ago.
Now, just how is it that this is leading edge?
I love the
Thomas.
Idea of not leading edge, but other side edge. Or I don't want to call it backwards.
Periphery.
Periphery, yeah. Periphery.
Well, and part of this, sounds like I'm making fun of it, but we tend to think linearly.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I go back to that metaphor of the mothers holding hands, and as if that leads boldly into a brilliant future. The old chain of being.
The great chain of being.
Perspective, and it's much richer than that. We learn lessons and then we forget them and then we go astray and sometimes, but it really does seem to me that and we were saying this in the break. This is the best psychology course I may have ever had in terms of what it means to be a human with other humans as well as human in the environment. And it seems to me as much as anything that's, I don't know if that's what was your intention, but one of the things you accomplished with this.
I'm glad to hear that. I don't think it was my intention. But I'm glad it worked out that way. That's
very nice. Having raised that, what was your intention? Why did you do this?
I wanted to re-examine the material we had seen and the experiences we'd had in the light of stuff that has been discovered in the intervening years, which is a lot.
Including your own life experience as well?
That too, but I mean, it would be things like the antelopes are water independent. I mean, that may have been known, but it wasn't, I mean, certainly not to me, and it wasn't generally known, and I didn't hear anybody, I mean, I was there with various people from time to time who were old Africa hand type people, and I never heard it from them, so I don't think they knew, they would have said.
But, there's been a lot of biology flowering and being better understood in those 50 years, hasn't there?
Yes.
And you've been reading it for 50
years. I've been reading quite a lot of it, yes. And there's been, so in other words, a great deal of stuff was known. Also, our human origins, the tongue, Raymond Dart, he discovered the Australopithecus in 1926, but because he was just a graduate student and a South African, he didn't have enough status to be the discoverer of this very important fossil. So it wasn't recognized as anything to do with our species until about the time we were starting our work.
So 25 years later.
Yeah, 25 years later. So that was, and also the antiquity of the Bushmen. There were things about the antiquity of their culture that we didn't know. Someone came and studied their music and found that the music, his name was Nicholas England, he was a musicologist, found that there were some very important music which was used at a woman's first menarche, called Elan music, was also present in other language groups of other Bushman language groups and other and also the Nama speakers, who are not exactly Bushmen, but they're related. And these all have the same Elan music. And this means that way back before these groups diverged, somebody wrote, invented, or composed Elan music. And then they took it with them.
And the Elan is an animal.
And the Elan is one of these water-independent antelopes, yes. And with the only animal with fat in its body, the only antelope with body fat.
Which says within the menarche recognition.
Yep. That we need some body fat in order to be able to menstruate or to be able to ovulate, and I think that's quite a wise evolutionary development, because better to wait until you have that rather than waste the all the energy and.
If you're starving, you're not going to be able to support the
baby.
It's
going to
take tremendous body energy to create and birth and take it.
Mm-hmm.
So the deep evolutionary wisdom, if you will, of many of these physical things, when my friend said, are there things to be learned? It was really thinking about your having had the experience and learning and coming back to share with us on about 7-11 different levels what you had seen, and then be able to enrich it. What an awesome opportunity. Your mother also did that.
She, yes.
In a rather a different way, but your mother, Lorna Marshall, whom you gave us the honor of knowing a bit, was singular in her ability to help us understand. And you quote her a great deal in The Old Way. And she was... Well, the word I keep thinking about, she, like the people that you met, she was awake.
She was very awake. She liked the people very much. They liked her very much. Named their kids for her. And other people. There were a lot of Lornas there after she had been there a while.
Yes. An ancient Bushman name.
Yeah, well, it became Noorna. But other people, too.
Go ahead.
Well, I said my word was primitive. There's a tendency to think of these people as primitive, but the corollary, I guess, to that is to think of them as ignorant.
Because
they don't know what we know. And again, reading this and from being in that context, I mean, if I were to be set down in that context, I'd probably last half a day at the outside.
Exactly.
And part of it is it is humbling. Which is a good thing, but it is also, to me, was a lesson in attending, a lesson in empathy and empathy attending to the world around you and making the appropriate adaptations. And these people were not ignorant. Their knowledge, frankly, was stunning. I mean, I was genuinely surprised, and the body fat is an example of that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, that's not obvious. The song would be about a creature who happens to have body fat, and they've made all the connections, and it's and this goes back, tens of thousands of years.
Many thousands.
I'm not sure how long it was before these groups split apart, but many thousands.
So I ought to get over this thing about ignorance too. as long as I'm getting over thinking of them as primitive, I probably should stop thinking of them as ignorant as well.
I doubt that you ever thought of them.
Thank you.
Well, I now get to defend the leading edge part. One of the things I found immensely engaging about this, and every time, which is already repeatedly, every time I pick up The Old Way, a story of the first people, it's sort of like picking up a Bible. And I couldn't possibly mean that with more sincerity. Every time I pick it up for a moment or for the day, I see something that you've already told me, and I hear it again in another way. I see something I hadn't seen before. And we live at a time of such crisis on the planet that, and I mean the Bible part, because in a way you have captured the best and the worst and the mediocre of us to give us an enriched palate looking at the challenges that we face on this planet, as part of this planet, to say, there's more to us than we've sort of narrowed ourselves down in specialties and in our separation and our differences and our individuality. Look at all that we are. Look at who we have been under very challenging circumstances. Well, why do you get fat in the summer? So that when it gets cold in the winter, you don't die. Well, there's a strategy for you. To begin to think about who we are in context seems to me to be an incredible gift, to both have lived it and to render it, and then to get feedback from people like me who say, really? Are you getting that kind of response from other people to say, oh, I didn't know that, or ooh?
well, some, yes. I haven't done very much talking about this book among people who didn't have some interest in this, or a knowledge of the subject. I've talked to a lot of people who are in the world of anthropology, and they're teaching anthropology, and they like the book. They feel they can use it as a text, a course book for anthropology, but they wouldn't be inclined to ask that kind of
thing. Well, it seems to me that you have, in a new and different way, really kind of given me an atlas to what kind of animal I am. Whether I want to be looking at how we are in the weather system, how we are in what we think of as religious, how we are in terms of gender roles. It's an atlas. And I can spend the first three chapters saying, look how we evolved to this and what the forces are, and oh, hunting, that's how far you can run. This is, we evolved as a chasing animal, mm-hmm. not as a stabbing animal. The richness of this, it would seem to me, A, that you would just kind of pop with all this stuff that you are graced to know, but then I guess the flip of that is, how do you put all that into your own life? As you're a white person who lives in New Hampshire who has grandchildren.
I don't think I put it into my own life by, you asked me earlier about having a garden. We don't have a garden. We did. But we don't. And as a result, the natural world comes closer to the house. The less you meddle with what is going on around you, the more the natural world will come to you. And, I mean, I'm very aware of what is going on in the woods, of what is going on with the deer. Mammals in general, but sometimes some birds, larger mammals, but some small ones, not the little bitty ones. I don't know enough about them, and I can't see them except moles I can see. But I mean, this kind of thing, it gave me a way to look at the world, which I love doing and can't get enough of it, and have no intention of changing ever. In fact, I'm putting a conservation easement on my land so that nobody else is going to change it either.
Fix them.
You've stayed more or less put.
Pardon me?
You've stayed more or less put. You know this land. You're not passing through.
No.
I mean, we're all passing through. But isn't there something of that, too? These Bushmen knew the territory, but they didn't. They didn't go to Paris for the weekend.
No. They did travel a lot. But they each group and each individual had birthrights to be at a certain. You had the right to drink the water and live at the area where there was water, in the place you were born. And I mean, people's mothers didn't just pass through and have a baby there. That wasn't ever. Possibly happened, but was not something that was taken into account. So it was just your birthplace was your clore, and where you had rights. And this is my clore. I mean, this is.
She says good. With a click in her mouth. We'll be back shortly with a couple more minutes with Elizabeth Marshall Thomas. Join us. Couple more minutes with Elizabeth Marshall Thomas here in Peterborough, New Hampshire. Peterborough, New Hampshire is the home of Thornton Wilder's story, Our Town. I think there is something elegant about what may be one of the great stories of the European experience cheek by jowl with a woman who is a selectman in Peterborough, New Hampshire, who also understands the old way. Does it ever get too much? Is there ever kind of a schizophrenia with all these pieces coming together? I would think the complexity of your life would be unique.
Well, it would if I thought about it. But if I don't think about it, I mean, this is here, and I mean, I have two worlds: the world of the town that I am very happy and honored to serve
as a selectman.
And I've been on a lot of town boards and stuff. I've done a lot of work for the town, but I'm very glad and honored to have the opportunity to do it. That's very, very nice for me. But then there's this, the outside and the natural world around here, which is it's just two different things. Well, that's usually about the natural world. I mean, I write the same book over and over.
Oh.
And, well, yeah, it has different place, different location, different characters or figures in the book, always different, but it is the same book. It's about that.
What's the theme?
That. The theme is the old way.
This is the Cliff Notes, right? All your other ones. First read this, then you'll get everything. Everything else is easy.
Yeah. I really want an answer to that. What is it that you tell over and over again?
I wrote a book about dogs, The Hidden Life of Dogs, and a book about cats, Tribe of Tiger. And I did that because these are non-human things that are very observable for us and very accessible for us. So anybody can look at their own dog, and if they know what to look for, they see all kinds of things that are going on out in the woods, and it's a connection. And it's anything not to be just human and human, things that humans have invented and things that humans diddle with, and just something to connect to the natural world. And I think, so that's why I did that. So those books, they have in them stuff that I learned in the Kalahari. Not necessarily happy stuff, but stuff nevertheless. And I'm writing now a book about deer, and again, it's the same story. It's what, but deer do it differently than people and dogs. You know, I mean, we're different species, so that adds a note of change.
That keeps it fresh, right?
Fresh.
That's a wonderful notion that you're writing the same book over and over again. It would seem to me that book is about being alive.
It's about being alive. Yeah, it is, Paula. But it's a being alive outdoors, or being alive as part of everything else that's alive, not just in your car.
Not just in your car. We'll continue this conversation another time and place. We thank you for this. You are, as always, the most gracious of hosts.
Thank you, Paula. Thank you, Bill.
Elizabeth Marshall Thomas's book, The Old Way, ranks among the world's great treasures. As with all of her other worthy works, it's written with compassion and great clarity. Words fail to fully express our gratitude to her, so let a simple thank you stand for the enormity of our appreciation. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.